This message comes from NPR sponsor Viore, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to viore.com/NPR.
Hey, it's Amna. I'm your host for this edition of the News Roundup. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly changing, and things may be different by the time you hear this episode. Stay up to date with all the latest by listening to your local NPR member station and visiting npr.org for all the latest. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, and it's time for another edition of the News Roundup. Let's get into it. Well, what a year it's been this week.
I can't ask our supporters to volunteer their time and donate their resources if we don't have a clear path to victory.
This race is far from over. There are dozens of states left to go.
But I said, wow, she's doing... Like a speech like she won. She didn't win, she lost.
Tonight, Nikki Haley was defeated. The problem is she's going to be dumb enough and she's going to be a fake candidate and she's going to keep going and we are going to destroy her in South Carolina.
Add to that, we've got more courtroom drama to catch up on. And is it any surprise that the man who played Ken in Barbie is up for an Oscar, but the women who brought Barbie to life, Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, aren't? Go figure. Well, let's welcome our panel. Steve Clemens is the founding editor-at-large at Semaphore and host of The Bottom Line on Al Jazeera English. Steve, welcome.
And the greetings.
Zoe Clark is political director at Michigan Public and co-host of the podcast It's Just Politics. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, hi.
And Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter at HuffPost. Arthur, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
So let's start with everything that's happened since this week's New Hampshire primary. Donald Trump walked away with another big win, seizing command of the race for the Republican nomination. The result was a setback for former U.N. ambassador and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She finished second despite investing a lot of time and money in a state famous for its independent streak. Haley's now the last major challenger to former President Trump after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis ended his presidential bid last weekend. But despite pressure on Haley to leave the race, she says she's not done yet. So, Steve, kick us off here. What reasons might Haley have for staying in?
Look, a lot of people chalk it up to delusion. That she is, like many people who set out to run for president of the United States, just a little bit off. The odds are so against anyone running and winning that why not go a little bit longer? The odds are there. I don't see it that way, though. I see that there are two things going on. One, there is the 0.0001% chance that Donald Trump finally says or does something that causes himself to implode, and she'll be the last person standing to take over. So as long as she holds out, she's an alternative who's credible and liked by a significant number of independent-leaning Republicans, if not Republicans themselves. So you've got that. And I think the other thing is she's positioning herself for the future. And I think for her to have a credible chance to run again, to be an alternative in the future, she's got to run in her own state, even if she loses that state. So remember, it's not just about this time in 2024. I think she may have chances in the future.
Zoe, at the top of the show, we heard Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene talk about, quote, destroying Haley in South Carolina. Tell us about how the former President Trump, has reacted to Haley's decision not to drop out.
Yeah, those are some fighting words. He doesn't appear happy about it. What could have really been a speech, you know, highlighting the win in New Hampshire instead turned into just sort of a blasting of Haley. He appeared furious, right? Instead of highlighting his victory. And then he went so far as talking about what she was wearing, which, of course, is not a first or new for Trump to talk about a woman's appearance. But it really appears it's gotten under the former president's skin that Haley is staying in the race, even though, as Steve said, it's a, you know, 0.0001% chance. You know, but she is going to, as she is saying, look to her home state of South Carolina, which we need to note does, you know, still also hold a lot of obstacles for her.
Well, to that point, you mentioned here now is former President Trump speaking to his supporters on Tuesday night.
You can't let people get away with bullshit, okay? You can't. You just can't do that. And when I watched her in the fancy dress that probably wasn't so fancy, come up. I said, what's she doing? We won.
Arthur, the former president's really never shied away from attacking his opponents, particularly if they are women. Look, if we assume it's just a matter of time before he has this nomination locked up, how much consideration do you think he's giving to who will be a vice presidential running mate?
Oh, he's thinking about it a lot right now, and he has lots of advisors telling him that he should pick a woman, but most people suspect it won't be Nikki Haley. It could be someone like Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, who has gone above and beyond pretty much everyone else on Capitol Hill in touting Trump's rhetoric and saying January 6th rioters were hostages. But there's also Tim Scott, who went up on stage at that event and said, I just love you. And so he's being encouraged to select a woman or a person of color, and those are two prime candidates.
What are the electoral risks? Because that's part of the big consideration for your running mate, right? If he chooses not to choose a woman, if he chooses another man, what's the risk for him?
I'm not sure what the risk would be. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that it would be advantageous for him to not pick another Mike Pence-type person because it would simply broaden his appeal. He is already the white guy, and he is well known for constant chauvinist remarks, such as the one about the governor's appearance on election day this week. So there's like an obvious reason to go in that direction.
We are talking today to Arthur Delaney from HuffPost, Zoe Clark from Michigan Public, and Semaphore's Steve Clemens. Now take a listen to this. And to be clear, what we're about to play is not real, and it's also a crime.
We'll need your help in electing Democrats up and down the ticket. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again. Your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
So the New Hampshire Attorney General's office is investigating what appears to be an attempt at voter suppression. NBC News was the first to report on that robocall impersonating President Joe Biden that, as you've just heard, urged people not to vote in Tuesday's presidential primary. Steve, we have talked about fake AI robocalls on 1A yesterday. We know they're a problem, but can lawmakers do much about them?
Well, they should be able to, but with the lethargy and paralysis in Washington has happened. Look, we all know Joe Biden, and I had chills listening to that tape because it sounds exactly like him, and this is the train wreck we've all been predicting would come with the availability of AI and the, you know, increasing prevalence of deepfakes we've seen out there, including a President Biden in video, Tom Hanks and others out there. So what we've heard from senators like Senator Deb Fischer and others out there is that this is a real problem, but that there's no way that Congress can enact anything at the federal level, both penalties and guidelines on this front, before the presidential election, before the November election. And that's just remarkable, meaning we've seen all this disaster coming at us and predicting. I just got back from Davos, where this is one of the biggest conversation points, how vulnerable American democracy is, and frankly, democracies for 40% of the world that are about to have elections in 2024. So it's a remarkable dereliction. And everyone is saying because we're so jammed up on other things and we can't get agreement that there's likely to be no action by the federal government and Congress.
Arthur, I see you nodding your head. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Congress is not going to do anything. They barely can keep the government open.
And how much of an issue do you think these kinds of robocalls are going to be, particularly for this election? We have a long general election ahead of us.
I am not sure what role they would play. I mean, this is the first one I can think of where it's got this AI component. And I mean, that's a whole nother can of worms that Congress won't touch. But as far as things that lawmakers care about, aside from what Deb Fischer said, I don't think it's really even on the radar.
Zoe, what about in Michigan? I mean, you know the role that messaging and advertising plays in all these elections. What are some of the early themes you're seeing there that aren't just about going after a candidate's personality?
Right. I mean, it's early here, so the GOP primary slash caucus here is not for another month. And there's just this absolute chaotic mess right now with intra-party fighting within the Republican Party. There are two different wings, both claiming party leadership, so that's taking a lot of oxygen. But Trump is strong among Republicans, and so the messaging is going to continue about the economy, how industrial Midwest states have been impacted over previous years. And we know, of course, that states like Michigan, like Wisconsin, like Pennsylvania are going to be crucial, again, for Biden to win, you know, this so-called blue wall if he's going to stay in the White House. You know, we can talk later in the hour, the UAW nominating or, you know, getting behind Biden, many Democrats going sort of finally. And so these are the conversations that are going to be had in Michigan and states, industrial states across the Midwest.
Arthur, I want to put to you one of our listener comments in coming in from Shula, writing, another factor supporting Haley staying in the race is the fact that Trump may be convicted one or two times, possibly more. What will be his status as a candidate at that point in time?
Well, even if he were convicted, that actually wouldn't stop him from being a candidate. He could be a candidate from prison. I don't think a conviction is necessarily that likely. He's got a strategy of delaying these trials, and he can appeal. So the thing to look at is whether a conviction substantially affects his standing in the polls. And that, we just don't know. We're in uncharted territory.
Well, we are rounding up the week's biggest news. We'll be back with more after this short break. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial. A member FDIC.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Well, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris hit the campaign trail together for the first time on Tuesday. The president and vice president zeroed in on one key issue, abortion rights.
And let there be no mistake, the person most responsible for taking away this freedom in America is Donald Trump.
Arthur, what were your big takeaways from this first joint campaign stop?
Like you said, this speech was exclusively about abortion rights, and that's a message that has been extremely effective for Democrats in the last several election cycles. And even though we're more removed from the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court, I don't think there's a real reason to believe that it won't continue to be effective. So it's politics 101 for Democrats who are on the much more popular side of this question.
Zoe, what are you seeing in Michigan on this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So before the break, you know, I was talking about the economy here in Michigan. But what we saw is this playbook from Governor Gretchen Whitmer in her reelection in 22. You know, she has started her Fight Like Hell PAC. That's after talking that she would fight like hell for women, for reproductive rights. It worked. She won by double digits in that election. And we know that is because it is a passionate issue for many, many voters. So this governor, among other Democrats, are going to urge this administration to continue to talk about abortion, to keep it front and center in voters' minds. I think the other thing that's interesting, too, is the timing. You know, we've all been talking and hearing about concerns within the Democratic Party. I mean, even former President Barack Obama seemingly coming out, you know, to the Biden administration saying, you got to start, you know, pushing this campaign right now. And so this week, we are starting to see that. Now, whether or not it's going to continue, who's going to be out for the Biden administration holding these rallies? It's not always going to be Harris and Biden together. That's going to be really interesting to watch over the coming weeks and, of course, months, you know, leading into November.
Steve, as you know, events overseas are also playing an outsized role in this election. And it struck me watching that rally with Biden and Harris that during the rally, protesters who opposed the president's position in the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza interrupted his speech multiple times. Tell us about those protests and what they say about potential vulnerabilities or weaknesses for Biden and Harris ahead.
Well, look, I think everything Zoe and Arthur just said is true. This is the one strong suit they have. But he's not talking about foreign policy because he's actually trailing Donald Trump in polls right now in foreign policy. He's not winning on Bidenomics. He's not out there resonating with climate or with fighting for the soul of the nation. So what we're hearing about abortion is that's where it's at. And what you're seeing from a younger generation of voters, I think it's very interesting, the generational divide about foreign policy. A lot of young people don't remember the Cold War. They don't remember the stakes about, you know, why Ukraine or independent states might have mattered with a nefarious Soviet Union, now the descendant of which is Russia, or in Israel, Gaza, seeing the hypocrisy of us turning a blind eye to now more than 25,000 people dead, mostly women and children, 60,000 injured. And I have to tell you that a lot of them are seeing, you know, women, to a mother and daughter hit by snipers in a church. This doesn't make sense as to why America, they see shipping, you know, 2,000-pound bombs, and on the other hand, wringing its hands, oh, please stop, you know, killing, you know, the unnecessary killing. So for a lot of young voters who do not understand the dynamics of foreign policy, where they look at Joe Biden as weak, as stuck with Netanyahu, and as unable to be a driving force for good. And it's the big danger for them is, I remember in the last election that brought Joe Biden in, they said what mattered was the youth, mm-hmm. that youth and young people voted in the Democrats. And guess what? That's where votes are collapsing and turning the wrong direction right now.
It's true. Yeah, Bidenomics has been a flop. People have been really mad about the economy, but that could turn around. There has been a shift in consumer sentiment. And, you know, the speech mm-hmm. this week marked the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. That's the reason it's focused exclusively there. But I think the White House will be more eager to take credit for happier economic sentiment if things keep going in that direction. So that's a big thing that everyone has assumed for the past year is automatically in Trump's favor that could go Biden's way.
Well, we should note President Biden hasn't lost appeal with one particular group. On Wednesday, the United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America, or UAW, officially endorsed Biden.
We need to know who's going to sit in the most powerful seat in the world and help us win as a united working class. So if our endorsements must be earned, Joe Biden has earned it.
That was UAW President Sean Fain speaking at a union conference in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. Arthur, how big a deal is that endorsement?
Well, it's interesting. The UAW endorsed Biden last time, so it's not a shock. But the context here is Donald Trump and some other populist Republicans are trying to position themselves as more supportive of the working class, more open to supporting union members. But Trump never really sealed the deal there, and he didn't pursue pro-union policies as president. And so the UAW endorsement shows that that didn't work. And Sean Fain also came out and said, quote, Donald Trump is a scab. And that was a pretty compelling statement from a union leader who has been able to make big headlines with his charisma for the past year or so.
That was in response to Mr. Trump going to a non-union plant, right, to talk about getting out the vote from folks there. Zoe, you are in Michigan now, and as you mentioned, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has been laying out her plan. She delivered her State of the State address on Wednesday. She's announced sweeping progressive reforms for the state, and she really credited President Biden with this quote, bringing jobs and supply chains home to Michigan. Tell us a little bit about Michigan's role in a potential Biden reelection.
Yeah, well, first, I want to just note, it was fascinating in that State of the State speech this week. She did mention Joe Biden twice in that speech, not as much as she mentioned the Detroit Lions, but close to it. And I think there's always this there's this interesting dynamic when you have a relatively popular governor, right, who is of the same party as, you know, a president whose numbers appear, at this state at least, to be underwater. As I was talking about a recent poll, it shows Trump beating Biden in a matchup in Michigan by 8 points. I can tell you that unless something bonkers happens before November, this is not going to be an 8-point race, though, for either candidate in November. Michigan is a purple state, right? It went for Obama in 12, went for Trump in 16, went for Biden in 20. But Whitmer is going to be an important part of, and she'll have a get-out-the-vote role for him. And as we're talking about, too, among younger voters, and that's going to be a dynamic in this state as well. Whitmer has been very close to the Biden administration. She was on the so-called short list of VP candidates in 20. She's his re-election campaign co-chair. So I should also note in that same poll I was talking about, her numbers, 61% approval rate. So she is going to be using some of that popularity, as she has statewide and a face of the administration nationally as well.
We are talking with Zoe Clark from Michigan Public, Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at HuffPost, and Semaphore's Steve Clemens. Well, Georgia's election interference case against former President Trump is in the headlines this week because of the prosecutors. Accusations of an inappropriate relationship between Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis and Nathan Wade, a special prosecutor that she hired on the Trump case, are in the spotlight. And on Monday, a Georgia judge unsealed documents in Wade's divorce case. And for the first time since the claim surfaced in court filings earlier this week, or this month rather, Willis spoke out.
Why does Commissioner Thorne and so many others question my decision in a special counsel? Lord, your flawed, hard-headed, and imperfect child, I'm a little confused. I appointed 3 special counsel, as is my right to do, paid them all the same hourly rate. They only attacked one.
That was Willis speaking at Big Bethel AME Church last week. Arthur, lay this out for it. What are they being accused of, and how could this impact the case against Trump?
So she hired these outside attorneys to help with this racketeering case against Trump and his co-conspirators. There are now allegations that one of them is actually a romantic interest of hers, which could be a conflict of interest because if the state is paying that person and then he is, for example, taking her on trips— It could look like a kickback, and that they have not exactly denied this. It hasn't been proven either, and so what she was saying in that speech is that it appeared to be a race motivated attack, that they were picking on this attorney because he's black, and the Trump lawyers, the co-conspirator lawyers, are saying, well, you are now injecting race into it, and so they've added it to their gripes, and this is actually seems like a significant problem for Fannie Willis.
More news out of the Supreme Court this week. In a 5-4 ruling on Monday, the court ruled that the federal government can remove parts of a razor wire barrier erected on the U.S.-Mexico border by Texas state law enforcement. The federal government argued this barrier illegally prevented them from managing the border. Steve, why did the justices side with the Biden administration in this case?
Well, I think basically these border they looked in at the federal level that this is an impeachment, that it is an endangerment to life, and they undid it. And so they came down with this, and it was a surprising decision, a mixed decision, but nonetheless, it kind of defanged some of the Texas toxicity over this.
And they didn't say why, but the government in its petition had said, look, there's a supremacy clause in the Constitution. States can't trump the federal government here, and that's always been the case on immigration policy, but it's still a live issue in the lower courts. And this is only for allowing Border Patrol to come in and cut the wire.
And we should note that Texas Governor Greg Abbott isn't backing down on this. State officials are saying they're actually installing more wire, even though the ruling gives federal agencies the right to cut it down. So where does this go from here, especially given the context of what we're facing at the border right now, which is record number of encounters?
It's an enormous PR play by the governor of Texas, and all other Republican governors, Republican members of Congress all have his back. So it's becoming a huge fight. It's potentially looks like an effort to nullify, the federal government's supremacy here. So it's potentially becoming a very big deal.
Definitely one to watch. Well, in another courthouse, a trial is now underway that could test the limits of who is responsible in a mass shooting.
Jennifer Crumbly didn't pull the trigger that day, but she is responsible for those deaths.
That was part of prosecutor Mark Keast's opening statement at an unprecedented trial for the parents of a teenager who killed four students at his high school in 2021. Zoe, tell us about the case and who were these parents and how big a deal this is in Michigan.
Yeah, this case is big. And it's a big deal across the country as well, as you note, because it's the first time that parents of a school shooter are being charged in a mass shooting at a school in the U.S. So it's alleged that the parents basically knew that their son was struggling with mental health issues. His father was the one who actually bought the gun that was used at Oxford High School. On the actual day of the shooting, the parents were called into the school to address violent and concerning images that were found drawn by this teenage shooter. But after 11 minutes, the parents left the school, the students stayed, and then this horrific shooting that killed, again, four students occurred. So this case is about parental responsibility and could certainly set precedent in future cases. And unfortunately, what we have seen in the United States over these years is school shootings are happening. They are happening more often. And so this is really going to be a case to watch.
Steve, how are you looking at this case? What are the implications for something like this?
Well, I think the implications of this are that we have a social reality where people and children and whatnot who are growing up in ecosystems and alarms are not going off about some of the perpetrators of some of the worst crimes out there. And we're looking at accountability networks. And I think that this is very important to look at what parents may have done or not done. But I think the broader side of it is, it's in my view also a distraction from the broader gun question, and we have to deal with that too. That when you kind of look at the prevalence and the ease of access to guns, that is now coming off as we begin putting parents on trial. So I can see both sides of this as you're beginning to look at how did this perpetrator and this mass killer become who he was in this case. And that is trying to distract, I think, from the fact that it's become very, very easy and we have a gun problem in this country that people are trying to ascribe to others.
It's the leading, gun violence is the leading cause of death of children in the United States. And it is legal for a parent to buy a gun, a handgun, and give it to your kid. Maybe that's weird. But this is the gun debate that doesn't happen. Like Steve said, in this case, it's just the particularly egregious alleged behavior by the parents that we're focused on and not the underlying issue.
We are rounding up the week's biggest news. We'll be back with more after this short break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with its original podcast On Investing. Each week, you'll get thoughtful, in-depth analysis of both the stock and the bond markets. Listen today and subscribe at schwab.com/oninvesting or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com. Support for NPR and the following message come from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
Well, this week, Ohio became the latest state to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth. The bill passed back in December, but Republican Governor Mike DeWine vetoed it. Here's what DeWine said about his veto last month.
These are gut-wrenching decisions that should be made by parents and should be informed by teams of doctors who are advising them. Were I to sign House Bill 68, or were House Bill 68 to become law, Ohio would be saying that the state, that the government, knows better what is medically best for a child than the two people who love that child the most, the parents.
On Wednesday, that bill became law when Ohio's GOP-led legislature overrode Governor DeWine's veto. The law will go into effect after 90 days. So, Arthur, tell us what this means for trans youth in Ohio and in neighboring states.
This law doesn't just ban surgeries and hormone therapy. It also bans mental health care. So if you're an Ohio family and this becomes a thing for you, you know, you'll have to leave the state to get care, unless it's something that you're already dealing with, in which case there's a grandfather clause, is my understanding. But this is what's happening in Republican states. There are laws like this on the books already in more than 20 other states. So this is the status quo for Republican state governance, and Mike DeWine is a huge outlier.
Well, talk to me about that. I mean, we have seen these kinds of bans, as you mentioned, in Republican legislature-led states across the country. How notable is it there's a disagreement here between the Republican governor and the Republican legislature?
It's very notable, but it's not something that is part of a national trend. You know, Mike DeWine's not running for the Republican nomination for president on this. He's making a noble point that this is contrary to our supposed preference for parental rights. It's the state strong-arming into private medical decisions. Like he said in that clip, you know, it couldn't have been clearer or more concise. And yet it's totally not what Republicans are saying anywhere else. He's on an island.
Let's turn now to the skies. Weeks after a door plug fell out of a Boeing 737 mid-flight, the Federal Aviation Administration announced the inspection process for Boeing 737 MAX 9 jets to be cleared to fly again. The grounding mostly affected United and Alaska Airlines. Alaska said the first of its 737 MAX 9s could be back in rotation as soon as today. In another bad day for Boeing, a 757 Delta jet lost a wheel before taking off Saturday in Atlanta. Thankfully, no one was injured and all the passengers deplaned safely. But Zoe, tell us what's going on with Boeing's safety and quality control practices.
Oof, that's the question, right? I mean, for years you sort of heard the word Boeing and you think airline and safety and strong planes and good reputation, but quality and safety issues have now been in the news for years when it comes to Boeing. And as you note, like, this month was no exception. That's after the blowout of part of a fuselage. Everyone by now has probably seen this video. I think for the average viewer, the average plane passenger, it's really scary to think about. So other airlines are looking at the issue. It turns out this is not an isolated issue, right? United Airlines say they found some loose bolts on some of their 737 MAX 9 planes as well. So, I mean, the focus now is on Boeing. The focus is on their safety standards and then the actual, like, putting the planes together.
Well, on Wednesday, Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun visited the Capitol to speak with senators.
I'm here today in the spirit of transparency to, number one, recognize the seriousness of what you just asked. Number two, to share everything I can with our Capitol Hill interests and answer all their questions, because they have a lot of them.
Steve, what were some of those questions that lawmakers had? And what's Boeing said it's going to do to address the safety concerns?
Well, I tell you, there was bipartisan astonishment at Dave Calhoun, who also said, we fly safe planes. We don't put airplanes in the air that we don't have 100% confidence in. And it was a remarkable comment. You could look at the faces of these senators, Jerry Moran of Kansas, Ted Cruz, on the same page basically as Maria Cantwell, who was saying, are you putting basically profits before safety?
And you know, they have the problem. Boeing has the problem. Boeing's in big trouble because, you know, like every other institution out there, you know, trust seems to be collapsing in it at this moment. And I think, you know, that trust is coming under pressure. And so you had these senators and members basically wanting to know how they're going to assure that the kind of bolt locking protocols that they have are done, what they're going to do under FAA supervision. Right now, Boeing is working very closely with FAA to get these MAX planes back out there. But it's not just about the MAX planes. It's about the fleet. It's about production. And it's about how Boeing operates. Because, you know, I tell you, I remember meeting George David, the CEO of United Technologies, that makes many of the engines on planes. And he says, we have to build these engines so that they're made forever, that they never fail, that there's a zero chance of failure. And that culture doesn't seem, at least from the view of many of the legislators that were grilling Dave Calhoun, to be part of the Boeing culture right now, as Zoe just said. And they've got to turn that round, and I don't think it's going to be easy for them.
Boeing shares are down 21% in the past month, so maybe the free market works.
That's Arthur bringing us the latest on this story. Look, before we break down some of the big media headlines, meanwhile, it's only right that we take a moment to acknowledge one of the greats that we lost this week. That was longtime CBS Sunday morning host Charles Osgood.
I cannot think of anything that has given me more pleasure professionally than Sunday morning, because first of all, it feels great to be part of something that people love, and I know that they do.
Charles Osgood signed off each broadcast with a surprising line for a TV broadcaster: I'll see you on the radio. Here he is announcing his retirement in 2016.
After nearly 50 years at CBS, including the last 22 years here at Sunday Morning, the time has come. And a date is set for me to do my farewell Sunday morning. It's September the 25th. After which, you can still see me on the radio.
Osgood got his start in radio. He was known for throwing rhymes into his news report and breaking into song.
So long, it's been good to know you. Been a long time since I've been home. And I've got to be drifting along.
Charles Osgood was 91 years old when he died this week. From a golden voice to some controversial golden statues. On Tuesday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science announced this year's Oscar nominations. The film Oppenheimer received the most nods, followed by Poor Things. Killers of the Flower Moon earned 10 nominations, including Best Actress. Nominee Lily Gladstone is the first Native American to be nominated in that category. And she told CBS she was video chatting with her family during the announcement.
Sure enough, I could barely hear my name, but I just saw my mom starting to fist pump in the air and my dad doing, I guess, what my grandma Lily always used to do, just clasping his hands together.
Absent from the Best Actress category was Margot Robbie, who starred in Barbie. The film's director, Greta Gerwig, was also snubbed, despite Barbie being among the nominees for Best Picture. Zoe, what's your reaction to who was and who wasn't nominated for Oscars this week?
Oh, Amna, you cannot make this up, right? I mean, like, this is what everybody is talking about. The irony is so thick. Maybe I'm, like, showing my age, but I remember being a middle schooler and listening to that Alanis Morissette song, right? Isn't it ironic? And this could literally be its own song. I mean, this is everyone is saying this is literally the plot of the Barbie movie. And we even saw Ken, right? Ryan Gosling come out and talk about this. So, I mean, I think it's sort of jaw-dropping, right? Again, because of the irony. And as we have had a year, as we've talked about on this program before, like Taylor Swift, Time Person of the Year, and Barbie. And then to have this happen was ironic, to say the least.
I thought Ryan Gosling was pretty good. I feel like he deserves the award. And it's not just because
And this is where we have the patriarchy, Arthur. Exactly.
I'm not saying this just because I resemble Ryan Gosling.
I resemble that remark. It is uncanny, the resemblance. Steve, weigh in here. What are your thoughts?
I just want to know what happened to Saltburn. Okay. You kind of, you know, you sort of look out there. But look, I mean, I think it is, you know, we always see in, you know, basically Hollywood is supposed to be, in many ways, we think of Hollywood as ahead of us socially, of opening doors, of helping us do things. And when it comes to these prizes and these Oscar nominations, It's abhorrent sometimes. I mean, I find the absence of Greta Gerwig to be very, very perplexing and disturbing. You know, when Ryan Gosling is out there saying, "Hey, this shouldn't be there," so you know, it becomes a reflection of I tell people, you know, we're sort of always on the verge of scientific technological breakthroughs, but if Galileo were alive, he would still be in jail. And I sort of feel like that's the same problem that Hollywood has.
Can I ask just for clarification too? Now, Steve, did you see the Barbie movie?
I did, twice.
Twice? And Arthur, have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay, great. Just want to make sure we have informed information here. That's good to know. That's good to know. Well, look, we need to turn now to another big story this week. That is the continuing turmoil facing our own industry, the news business. The industry is suffering through widespread layoffs. It's a trend with especially grim updates in the past couple of weeks. On Tuesday, the LA Times laid off more than 20% of its newsroom. That's about 115 people. That came after last week's news of mass layoffs at Sports Illustrated, and now the future of that magazine is in doubt. Steve, this is a continuation from last year. NPR, Vox, National Geographic, a lot of other news outlets cut staff. Tell us about what's behind the trend.
Well, look, I mean, what you said very importantly is it's a trend. I mean, some of the big players, the New York Times and whatnot, continue to grow and amass power and status and footprint. The LA Times has been dying for decades. But I think there are new powerful inflection points that have come into this, and AI is one. I think another is that the continued squeezing of people's attention into a fragmented scene, more and more people are getting their news and their kind of, you know, hits that they want to from TikTok, you know, from new social media, from others. And so the old idea of centralized platforms that you go to regularly for news is just part of a different era than we're in now. And so AI, that, and the fact that companies like CBS, you know, Sherry Redstone and others, you know, facing huge bills from the government, and she's got to downsize, make that thing profitable, and perhaps, you know, sell some of these big networks. So I think that all of this is putting negative pressure. Plus, we've gone through a horrible ad environment this past year, which has not fully come back. So the dynamics of how to keep these big behemoth media organizations alive is just not there.
But the ad dynamic is not like we're having some bad weather. I mean, there's policy underlying this, and there's monopolistic behavior in the ad markets, which are dominated by gigantic tech firms. And, you know, you could add this to the list of things that Congress will certainly never tackle, but it's not just like this is happening because the earth is turning. This is policy, and this is bigger than just each different layoff that we see.
And there's been some big media leadership changes we should talk about, too. NPR announced its new CEO will be Catherine Marr. She formerly led the Wikimedia Foundation. Here she is talking to NPR about that work.
The thing that I loved in my last role was that 85% of our funding came from small-dollar donations. 85% of $140 million by the time I left, which is a huge amount of people giving $2 to $3 in support of that mission.
Zoe, talk to us about the challenges ahead for a leader like Marr taking on NPR, and especially in this current media landscape.
Yeah, I mean, all of them. All of the challenges. I mean, we heard Steve and Arthur really dig into the lay of the land when it comes to the media landscape right now. And NPR is no different. The network has seen layoffs itself, and really important conversations also about a diversity and representation among its staff and among the audience that we serve. We have to note, too, with this new CEO, NPR will have gone through 10 leaders in the past 20 years. So, of course, in any environment, setting strategic direction can be really difficult when you see that kind of turnover. So all of those challenges are happening, but I have to be on my soapbox for a moment and say public media is still an absolute gem within this media landscape, whether it be NPR, whether it be PBS NewsHour. I mean, here you are listening to an entire hour about the news and better understanding what it means for you. And so, I mean, there are huge challenges, but again, NPR is such an institution. And I think having a younger voice at the table and someone who's led a lot of interesting boards too, it's going to be fascinating to watch this future.
I might be slightly biased, but I have to say, I agree on the role of public media right now. Shout out to my PBS NewsHour colleagues. Well, look, finally, Zoe, we got you here. We got to talk about this. Let's talk about football. It centers around the state of Michigan. The Detroit Lions advanced to their first NFC championship game in 32 years, playing the San Francisco 49ers this Sunday. And the University of Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh has accepted an offer to coach the LA Chargers next season. That's after a remarkable run with the Wolverines that included a national championship this year. Zoe, how's Michigan feeling right now?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a sports ball fan, this is this is the place to be over the past few weeks. We've got the Detroit Lions one game away from the Super Bowl. The Lions are one of only four teams that have never made it to the big game. So just getting this far is a huge deal to this team and to the city of Detroit and really to the state.
Our thanks this week to Zoe Clark, political director at Michigan Public, also to Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at HuffPost, and to Steve Clemens, the founding editor-at-large at Semaphore.
Like a sound you hear that lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset.
Before we head to the global edition of the News Roundup, we remember the fantastic jazz and soul singer Marlena Shaw. Shaw was born Marlena Burgess in New Rochelle, New York, and began her music career in the 1960s performing in jazz clubs. Shaw released 17 albums with 8 different record labels. She's best known for her hit California Soul. The song was written by Ashford and Simpson and has since been sampled by other artists. It's been a favorite for those who make TV commercials, who are looking to sell you something cool with a good vibe. Marlena Shaw died this week. She was 81 years old. So the people started to sing, and that's how the surf gave birth, I'm told, to California Soul. Coming up on the global edition of the News Roundup, the war in Gaza grinds on for more than 110 days, protests against the far right in Germany, and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi inaugurates a Hindu temple in the culmination of a decades-long dispute. All those stories and more after a short break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, HubSpot. What if you could find, track, and close deals all in one place? Now you can thanks to HubSpot Sales Hub, a connected, customizable sales platform that's a joy to use. Try it at HubSpot.com/sales.
Let's meet our panel for the global edition of The Roundup. That is David Rennie. He's in Beijing, bureau chief for The Economist and co-host of the Drum Tower podcast. Hi, David.
Hello.
And from London joining us, my colleague Layla Milana Allen, special correspondent at the PBS NewsHour. Layla, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Amna.
And here with us in studio is Jack Detch, national security reporter at Foreign Policy. Jack, it's great to see you.
Good to be here, Amna.
So let's start with the war in Gaza. Gaza's health ministry says today that the number of people killed in Gaza since October 7th now stands at more than 26,000 people. Two-thirds of those are women and children. 1.7 million Palestinians in Gaza are now displaced from their homes. And the Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 83 journalists have been killed. Israel says more than 1,200 Israelis have been killed since October 7th, most on that day when Hamas brutally attacked communities in the south of the country. And about half of the approximately 250 Israeli hostages taken by Hamas still remain captive. Well, this morning, the International Court of Justice delivered a preliminary ruling on the emergency measures requested by South Africa in a genocide case against Israel over the war.
In the court's view, the aforementioned facts and circumstances are sufficient to conclude that at least some of the rights claimed by South Africa and for which it is seeking protection are plausible. This is the case with respect to the right of Palestinians in Gaza to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts identified in Article 3, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligations under the convention.
So that South Africa filed the case against Israel before the court in December, alleging that the offensive in Gaza amounts to state-led genocide and stands in breach of the UN's Genocide Convention, signed in 1948 as the world's response to the Holocaust. Leila, what can you tell us about the significance of today's ruling?
Well, it's incredibly significant for a few reasons. Now, this is really just the beginning of this process. This is only the fourth time that one of these cases has been brought to the ICJ, which is just a court at the UN that is for states to bring cases against each other. It's not the much more famous International Criminal Court, which is for trying individuals. Now, this is absolutely the beginning of this process. I said it could take years for the court to define whether they believe genocide has happened in this case. But what South Africa was pushing for initially was preliminary steps. So they wanted a preliminary judgment. They wanted the court to call for a ceasefire immediately while they figured out whether genocide had happened. Now, the court has stopped short of that. There were concerns that if they did call for a ceasefire, Israel would then ignore that. It would go to the UN Security Council. The US might then veto that move. That hasn't happened. But what they have done is several significant steps. As you heard there, that was the head judge of the court, Joan Donoghue, who said, firstly, that South Africa did have the right to bring this case as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and Israel, of course, is also a signatory to that convention. Secondly, that Palestinians in Gaza are protected under this convention as part of a group, which is wider Palestinians. And thirdly, that the court did have the jurisdiction to judge on this. So that's very important. They will move forward with that. In the meantime, what they have done is they brought out some preliminary judgments. Now, these are binding, but there's no actual mechanism to enforce them, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. They brought in six provisional measures, and among them are saying that Israel must try and stop in any way it can the killing of Palestinians, the injuring of Palestinians, the displacement from their homes, and the prevention of them being able to have children. Now, one of the big problems here with these provisional measures that people have immediately pointed out is it says Israel must in any way it can stop the killing of Palestinians. Mm-hmm. That includes their military. And of course, every day the IDF is currently killing Palestinians. So it's very unclear how Israel will react to these judgments. They've been told to submit a report on how they're reacting to these provisional measures within a month to the court. And secondly, they may just say, as the Israeli government and the IDF have been saying for a long time, we're already doing our best.
Well, David, tell us more about that. What reaction have we seen from Israel and the leadership there?
It's been a very interesting reaction. I mean, there was clearly a lot of discipline imposed on ministers in the government. There's reporting in Israel that the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, ordered ministers not to speak out freely. And you saw this very careful kind of approach by Israel to try and present this as a war between two armed groups and not involving civilians at all. And so you saw the foreign ministry saying that Israel is committed to international law, but not because of this court case, and that this is a war against Hamas, not against civilians. So trying to frame this as an army on an army, if you like, and try and sidestep the whole question. You then saw, I guess, predictably, a much angrier public response from the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, where he said that, although he noted the court had, in his view, rightly rejected the outrageous demand that would deny Israel its right to self-defense, he then attacked the idea of genocide at all and saying that it was a disgrace that will be felt for generations, that the court raised it. But this is a very divided Israel, of course. And I think one fascinating detail, I was just reading the court judgment now, is Israel sent a judge to the panel, Aharon Barak, who's himself a Holocaust survivor, and a voluble critic, a frequent critic of Benjamin Netanyahu, and you know the exact kind of type of liberal justice that Benjamin Netanyahu normally rails against. He was sent to defend Israel's case. He backed Israel on the main counts of genocide, but he actually voted with the majority to say that it should be outlawed to incite genocide against Palestinians. And also he voted with the majority, the Israeli judge, to say that there should be provision of humanitarian aid. So I think you can see in that that the Israeli judge himself was siding with perhaps critics of the Netanyahu government. So you mm-hmm. see that in this moment of extreme suspicion and tension, that kind of pluralism of Israel can still be glimpsed, even in this kind of very dark hour.
Jack, tell us about where the rubber meets the road on this, right? The full ruling is likely to take years. The court's looking at South Africa's request for emergency measures here to protect Palestinians from potential breaches of the convention. Is it clear if Israel will comply? I mean, how much does this ruling matter?
Well, let's start with the big parental advisory-sized sticker, if you would, the disclaimer that both of the guests hinted at. The court is only deciding right now whether this case is plausible that South Africa presented. It's not a final determination of genocide. But it's going to be pretty hard to enforce this or move forward when Israel fundamentally disagrees with the premise. One thing that Netanyahu said specifically in coming out in reaction after this ruling is that this is an effort to deny Israel the right to defend itself. And while the ICJ has the ability to ask for a report on Israel's conduct, it can't really call balls and strikes under this ruling. So this is likely to become more political in the coming days. I mean, we have to remember, too, this is South Africa presenting this ruling. South Africa has supported 99 anti-Israel resolutions since 1994. So you're likely to see more of this tit for tat between the Israelis and the South Africans at this point.
Layla, this week there were reports that Israel has given Hamas a proposal through Qatari and Egyptian mediators that included a pause in fighting for up to 2 months as part of a multi-phase deal that would also include the release of all of those remaining hostages held in Gaza. What should we understand about that deal?
Well, when we first saw this coming to light last week, initially it looked like it had been immediately blown out of the water. There was this suggestion that Israel proposed, as you say, up to 2 months of a ceasefire in exchange for the release of the hostages. Hamas leadership came back and immediately said there was no way that they would release the hostages unless there was a complete end to the war. And Benjamin Netanyahu said immediately there was no way that that would happen. They weren't going to have a complete... he said it would be a surrender if they did have a complete end to the war at this stage. So it looked like that deal was over. There now has been a big doubling down by lots of international partners to try and make this happen. Of course, there have been efforts to have another ceasefire since that humanitarian pause in November when half of the hostages were traded over. The director of the CIA, William Burns, seems to be travelling this week. The head of Mossad is travelling with him as well. They are meeting the Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister before he travels to Europe as well. And they're all negotiating over potentially how they might be able to make this happen. And they're also working alongside Egypt as well. So there really is hope that with all this international pressure, they might be able to move it forward. Now, the suggestion through various sources that have been speaking is that this would be phased. So there would be an initial humanitarian pause during which initially remaining female civilian and children hostages, of whom there are not many left, most were released in the last round, would come first. That would then be met with more aid being allowed to go into Gaza and some more Palestinian prisons being freed from Israeli jails. Then if that worked, the ceasefire would extend a little bit more. And then we'd start looking at female soldiers and male civilians. And the final stage would be those male soldiers, who are, of course, the most contentious thing. And the issue here is that Israel is presenting many of these young soldiers who were kidnapped on October 7th as young people, defenseless young people who've been kidnapped. Hamas maintains that they are military, they are soldiers, they are prisoners of war, and that's why they haven't released them. So that's really the crux of this. But what's very important here, these negotiations are ongoing, is that neither side appears to have pulled out in the last few days. Previously, we've always seen either Hamas or the Israeli government say, no, throwing in the towel, this isn't happening. Both sides do seem to still be open to this negotiation. So maybe it's possible that through the weekend, with all these moves, they may be able to move this forward.
Some breaking news to bring you now. The United States has just announced it is suspending additional funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, as it temporarily reviews allegations that 12 UNRWA employees took part in Hamas's October 7th terror attack on Israel. The issue is currently under investigation. David, I want to bring you in here now because we know that fighting continues through the Gaza Strip, and in particular in its second largest city, Khan Yunis, where United Nations officials have said that tank rounds hit a UN facility there where people were sheltering, killing at least 12 and wounding 75 others. The Israeli military said its forces were battling Hamas operatives in the area. They deny shelling civilians. But tell us a bit more about what conditions are like in Khan Yunis, which was until recently one of the IDF's evacuation zones.
That's right. So this is right, as you say, it's the second largest city. It's right down in the south of Gaza, near the border with Israel. And it has these very large, we call them refugee camps, but that doesn't mean they're kind of new encampments of tents. These are essentially kind of cities that have been there for decades, although they're not in good condition. with people who are displaced from elsewhere in the region. And the Israeli army is clearly, its assault is essentially focused on Khan Yunis at the moment, and the fighting is clearly extremely intense. And as you say, earlier this week, we had this confused and now seemingly rather tragic, real tragic attack by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, on a training center, which is sheltering, according to the United Nations, 30,000 people. And one particular building with about 800 people in it was hit by what appears to be, according to the UN, Israeli tank fire. Though I should say the Israeli military denies it, says it's still investigating. Maybe it was Hamas fire. But the UN seems clear that this started a fire which killed at least 9 people and wounded others. And you can see that this is part of the story that we're seeing all over Khan Yunis this week, that the Israeli Defense Forces say that they have to chase Hamas fighters wherever they find them. So that includes in these shelters where people are huddled, civilians. It also includes several hospitals, which the Israeli army says are being used by Hamas fighters. They say they can see them holding things like rocket-propelled grenades, carrying weapons. They're calling in airstrikes. But these are also undeniably hospitals with civilians and doctors mixed up in them. So it is an absolutely appallingly intense fight in a very crowded city, urban environment. And as you say, filled with people who had actually moved there from elsewhere because they thought that it might be a safe haven. And now the IDF is warning people to leave large chunks of Khan Yunis and head on further towards the coast. But it's an example of just how utterly brutal and messy this fighting, and how each side is accusing the other of being responsible for these clashes that are catching up civilians in a really tragic way.
Meanwhile, inside Israel this week, family members of some of the approximately 130 hostages still held captive by Hamas stormed a finance committee meeting in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, on Monday. Some of the protesters were holding up photos of captive family members, and they were shouting, "Shame on you." Jack, what message were they trying to send to lawmakers with this?
Look, I mean, it just shows that the level of controversy this has caused in Israel, the level of pushback even within the country about the tack that Netanyahu has taken during the war. You see his coalition being very fragile right now. He's been pushed to the far right by far right forces. Of course, this is something that's been ongoing since the summer with the judicial reviews. So you just see, again, sort of a conglomeration of this spectrum across Israeli politics, the left pushing back, the far left pushing back. It certainly seems like this is something they're going to have to contend with, especially since Netanyahu could be going to elections this year if that government does fall apart.
Well, Leila, it's worth mentioning Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's facing criticism from the government of Qatar. This follows leaked private remarks that Netanyahu made saying that the Gulf countries' efforts in negotiations between Israel and Hamas were, quote, problematic. What's the story behind those leaked remarks, and how could this impact the relationship?
Well, he is becoming increasingly more unpopular inside Israel. Now, he has been extremely critical throughout of the Qataris as negotiating partners. The Israeli government at large has constantly said, you know, they harbor terrorists, they shouldn't be allowed to have Hamas living there, they should be arresting themselves. Of course, everyone was suddenly very grateful when Qatar was able to negotiate the release of those hostages in November. But now, again, we're seeing this fighting talk. This has come out. These are obviously private comments, and it's not very helpful to the negotiations that are happening right now. But it has come out again that, you know, that the Israelis essentially feel that if Qatar is going to be doing something, they should be doing more than what they're doing right now. They're being too sympathetic to Hamas. On the other side, there has been this suggestion that perhaps one of the ways that a ceasefire could be agreed is that Hamas leadership will be allowed, the ones who are still inside Gaza, will be allowed to leave. And of course, the natural place for them to go would be Qatar. So both Netanyahu and his government are slightly playing both sides here, criticizing Qatar when it suits them to say that they're harboring terrorists, and then bringing them on board when it does suit them, when they want to play there. But of course, Bibi now is fighting on so many different sides, as Jack mentioned there. You know, he was widely unpopular last year. We had tens of thousands of Israelis taking to the streets against him. And now that is rising again with these families of hostages, with people who feel that too many young IDF soldiers now are dying inside Gaza, and with many who feel that this simply isn't the way to achieve peace after October 7th. Just 15% of people in Israel, in a recent poll done last week, believe that they wanted Netanyahu to stay in as the leader of Israel after this war finishes.
Well, the United States, meanwhile, is ramping up its military campaign in parts of the Middle East. The U.S. struck three sites in Iraq and took out two anti-ship missiles in Yemen operated by the Houthi rebel group. The strikes in Iraq and Yemen are both tied to the threat against U.S. military and commercial vessels in the Red Sea. David, there have been more than 150 attacks on U.S. facilities in Iraq and Syria since Israel's war with Hamas began. What does the U.S. military action say right now about how the war is affecting the rest of the Middle East?
I think that it's sort of honest to say that some of this military action by the United States and the UK, its ally, is political as much as military, because we've had President Biden himself admitting that these attacks on the Houthis, which often involve, you know, extremely expensive warplanes and submarines firing extremely expensive missiles at essentially kind of runways for drones or fairly basic missiles provided to the Houthis by their allies, Iran. And so, you know, President Biden himself admitted that this wasn't actually stopping the Houthis from attacking ships, but that nonetheless this continued, because there is a sense that if you don't show some force, you can't deter the Houthis. But in fact, there's also a diplomatic track, which in some ways may be much more important, where we're seeing the Americans leaning very hard on anyone who can put pressure on the Houthis, which means above all the Iranians. And because, of course, the Americans don't have a channel to the Iranians, they're going to people like the Chinese. China bought 90% of the crude oil that came out of Iran last year. China is, in fact, sailing cargo ships fairly with impunity past the Houthis, because the Houthis are not attacking Chinese ships. And we gather that Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, is going to meet Wang Yi, the top Chinese diplomat, next week in Bangkok. And one of the absolute items at the top of the agenda for the Americans is pushing the Chinese as hard as possible to lean on the Iranians to stop these attacks on shipping. Because although China does not want to condemn the Houthis, certainly doesn't want to condemn Iran, China has a lot of goods on a lot of ships, and it doesn't necessarily want the economic chaos of seeing the Suez Canal and the Red Sea closed.
Well, let's move now to news of the war in Ukraine. It's been nearly 2 years since Russia's full-scale invasion. Republican lawmakers here in the U.S. are putting into doubt a bipartisan deal that would provide $60 billion in aid to Ukraine. That deal is tied to more stringent border policy changes. Earlier this week, U.S. lawmakers said they were closing in on a deal. That changed after former President Donald Trump slammed the negotiations and cemented his lead as the frontrunner in the Republican presidential primary. Jack, tell us about these new dynamics and how much of a wrench former President Trump is putting into the works.
Well, he's not putting a wrench in the deal, Amna. He's breaking the chain, because this had been the linkage that the doggedly pro-Ukraine Republicans in Congress, the Mitch McConnells of the world, the Michael McCalls, had done. They'd linked up, as you said, that border support with the Ukraine aid, that $60 billion that the Biden administration proposed to reload Kyiv's guns. That was sort of the way they thought they could placate the pro-Trump wing of the caucus while moving forward with the aid. But now we've seen Trump really maneuvering behind the scenes with much more success to kill the deal. The whole upshot for Trump here is to avoid giving Biden a political win and keep that march going to the Republican nomination. This is a very, very difficult balance for the McConnells of the world, because they don't want to be seen as outwardly publicly anti-Trump. At the same time, they're trying to build this case for Ukraine aid. That's the awkward tightrope that they'd always been marching. Now it seems they might have fallen off and into the ravine. And of course, the Ukrainians are suffering here, because as this aid is decoupled, the Ukraine aid itself is not likely to fly in the House, and they're running out of all sorts of ammunition here.
What is the path forward? Do we know that yet, or is it still unclear?
It certainly looks like it could be two solo bills. It's not certain how that would be a path forward, certainly in the House. We saw Mike Johnson, when he first became Speaker of the House, being somewhat pro-Ukraine, but mutedly pro-Ukraine. He sort of seems to have backed off of that now that Trump is trying to deny Biden this political win. And remember Trump's public comments too, right? He wants to solve the war in Ukraine in a day. He thinks he can talk to Vladimir Putin. So he's not necessarily the person who's going to be in favor of reloading Ukraine's guns in perpetuity in the way that we've seen the Biden administration doing, and certainly pro-Ukraine lawmakers in Congress, the Republicans among them, pushing for as well.
Well, on Wednesday, a large Russian military transport plane crashed in Russia near the Ukrainian border. Russia's accusing Ukraine of downing the plane, and it said all 74 people on board were killed. The Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that 65 of those killed were Ukrainian prisoners of war who were being transported for a swap. Ukrainian officials didn't comment on the accusations, but said it was not informed that prisoners would be flown. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called for an investigation into the crash.
It is obvious that the Russians are messing with the lives of Ukrainian captives, the feelings of their relatives, and the emotions of our society. All clear facts must be established. To the extent possible, given that the aircraft crashed on Russian territory beyond our control, facts is the key word now.
And in Belarus, the country adopted a new military doctrine that would permit the use of nuclear weapons. The doctrine would allow for the use of weapons in the event of armed aggression against itself or its allies, which includes Russia. Last year, Russia moved tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, where Moscow says it would maintain control over them. David, all of this sounds very concerning, but explain a little bit more about this doctrine and what it could mean for the war in Ukraine.
I think we should probably see this as an extension of Vladimir Putin's consistent willingness to use kind of nuclear blackmail as an attempt to intimidate the West. Belarus, it is a separate country, but only just after its dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, basically rigged his last election pretty egregiously and triggered mass protests. He was bailed out and rescued by the Russians, and the Russians now have him as a sort of semi-colony of Russia. So at the end of the Soviet Union, Belarus gave all of its nuclear weapons back to Russia. Some of those, allegedly, we don't know for sure, did return to Belarus last year. Their tactical nuclear weapons, which is kind of jargon for battlefield nuclear weapons, still very dangerous, but not the sort of things that can level an entire city. And this idea that they've adopted a new doctrine, which is about their obligations to their allies, I think is just another way for Russia to kind of wave a nuclear saber at the West and just say, you know, don't push us too far on Ukraine, because we're willing to go all the way.
And Jack, when we look at the war in Ukraine as well, and this holdup, the inability of the U.S. to pass additional funding, it feels very much like it's moved into sort of a frozen conflict. Where does that war stand? What does the path forward look like?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's what we've seen in the past couple of months. The Ukrainians didn't have much luck moving forward the front lines in their three-month counteroffensive, got about 100 kilometers. You haven't seen the Russians basically in the intervening 3 months get very far. They've thrown a lot of bodies at Avdiivka in the east. There have been a lot of Russian deaths. Now we're up to 300,000 casualties on each side. The problem in Ukraine is just mobilization is getting enough bodies. And now the Zelensky administration is sort of searching in every nook and cranny to get more Ukrainian males active, ready for service, ready for fight. But they don't have as many people. Remember, this is a country of 44 million up against a country of more than 100 million. So it's a numbers game, and Ukraine is in a tough position here.
Well, thanks in part to the war in Ukraine and the war in the Middle East and the climate crisis and the rise of artificial intelligence, we're apparently all closer to global catastrophe. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists kept the so-called doomsday clock as close to midnight as ever. The doomsday clock is set yearly, and for the second year in a row, it's been 90 seconds to midnight. That's the closest the clock has been to Armageddon. Leila, as a journalist with your eyes on the globe, covering a lot of these stories up close, what do you make of this assessment?
Well, it doesn't look good, does it? Coming into 2024, I don't think many of us are feeling hugely positive about world affairs. Now, of course, the doomsday clock has not changed this year. It is still 90 seconds to midnight as it was last year. But the people who designate this have been very quick to say that's not a positive thing. We should be moving it backwards. We are keeping it so close because all these threats are still around. Now, of course, the doomsday clock is about nuclear collapse of the globe by whoever starts it, but it's driven by many other factors there. Of course, we just heard about Belarus now saying that it, you know, potentially used nuclear weapons as well. Of course, during the Gaza war, we heard one Israeli minister say that he thought they should consider dropping a nuclear bomb. You know, we haven't really had to worry about nuclear war for a while. And unfortunately, there are so many conflicts going on at the moment, that there are so many different places to watch, and that's only increasing. Now, of course, we've got, you know, this conflict happening in the Red Sea as well, which risks the whole globe's food supply, the economy. So it really is extremely worrying. And of course, the backdrop to that as well is that the entire planet is burning. After a year that had the hottest summers on record, we're now facing another year of wildfires, of massive droughts, of massive floods. So however the world does come to an end, unfortunately, 90 seconds to midnight at the moment doesn't seem that far off.
Moving now to Germany, where tens of thousands of people took to the streets this week to protest the country's far-right political party, Alternative for Germany, or AfD.
I'm afraid my kids won't grow up in a democratic Germany.
The public outcry comes after it was revealed that senior members of the party discussed their plan to deport migrants in droves. David, what more do we know about this controversial immigration plan?
I mean, it's more than just a controversial immigration plan. You're seeing, if not tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Germans all over the country, in big cities, but also actually small provincial towns, coming out and saying that this is not just a policy that they disagree with. This to them seems like a real threat to the kind of democratic model that has prevailed in Germany since the end of World War II, where Germany, of all countries in Europe, explicitly believed that it could never afford to allow neo-Nazis or the far right into mainstream politics. And the problem is that the AfD, who are not neo-Nazis, but they're clearly a populist anti-immigrant right-wing party, they are now, by some polls, the second most popular party with a particular strong support in the former communist East. And they had a meeting, some of their members, at a villa near Potsdam with an Austrian politician, Martin Sellner, who is an ex-neo-Nazi, now arguing that there is a need for what he calls, re-migration, or sending millions of people who have not, in his view, correctly assimilated out of the country. And the shock of seeing German politicians, including one senior aide to the leader of the AfD, who was then later sacked for being at this meeting, talking to this Austrian who is basically very close to the extreme right about this really sinister policy. You saw not only those vast demonstrations, but actually Germany's own president, for example, saying that these demonstrators, in his view, were standing against right-wing extremism and misanthropy, and this was the soul of democratic Germany at stake.
Well, so David, so far people have actually drawn comparisons between the AfD and Nazi-era Germany. Are those accusations fair or overblown?
I think it's very, very important not to try to deny that the AfD has an enormous support. And it isn't a neo-Nazi party. It has enormous support, which is very troubling. But this is the nightmare that post-war German politicians had. What happens when the populist right turns up in German politics? And, you know, scolding it, denouncing it, pointing the finger at it is not stopping very large numbers of people, particularly in the depressed former industrial, former communist areas in eastern Germany, from thinking that that is the answer. And you can see that Germany is wrestling with the idea that, you know, Germany isn't like any other European country. You know, there's a far right in power in Italy. You've got the far right doing well in some elections in France. But Germany has always believed that it couldn't afford to allow such arguments out into public. And so you're now seeing, for example, the discussion about whether the Austrian politician who was at this meeting in November that was written up by a German news organization, that maybe he should be banned on sort of legal grounds from Germany. So Germany is really wrestling with basic freedoms, but also trying to keep those kind of most incendiary arguments out of public discourse.
So, Jack, we're just months away from three major regional elections in eastern Germany, and polls say support for the AfD is the strongest there. When you look at these protests, do they say to you that maybe they'll hamper the chances of the AfD to advance on election day?
Right. Let's look at the geography, because remember, in Germany, it's an east-west thing. The big protests were in big western cities, but the AfD is strongest in the east, in Saxony, Brandenburg, and I'm going to try and pronounce this, Thuringia, the former Soviet communist strongholds. And that's where a lot of the elections are being held. Those are the places where they're leading in the polls. They have a commanding lead. So the initial read is this isn't going to hurt the AfD politically in those places, because that's not where the protests are. Ultimately, what it's going to show is how polarized Germany is. And my colleague Allison Meekham at Foreign Policy, we were slacking this morning, she made the case, it's kind of similar to asking, will the Women's March in the United States hurt Trump's chances? Probably not. It's just going to further polarize the country on right and left grounds.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, lawmakers in Turkey voted to let Sweden join NATO. The vote makes Hungary the only country in NATO that's not voted to recognize Sweden as a member. David, Turkey has been accused of delaying Sweden's NATO membership for more than a year. So why the change of heart?
It's a grubby deal. So the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, also signed this agreement on Thursday. So Turkey is now essentially, after 20 months of delaying Sweden's accession, going to let it through. And this is clearly linked to the fact that Turkey wants to buy F-16 fighter jets and F-16 modernization kits from America. And we have seen the Biden administration saying that those F-16s will be allowed to flow to Turkey. And this points to a larger problem for NATO, which is that NATO, the alliance formed after the, you know, during the Cold War, the West versus the Soviet Union, actually contains members who try and play both sides of the game. And Turkey is also pretty close to Russia, has been doing quite a lot of business with Russia. Sweden is not out of the woods yet. That Sweden, which has been neutral forever and ever, for centuries, it's a really remarkable thing to see Sweden joining its neighbor Finland in rushing into NATO as a result of the war in Ukraine, still has one more NATO member to convince, because you need unanimity in NATO. So Hungary, led by the right-wing populist Viktor Orban, is also holding out and trying to essentially extract what concessions he can from NATO and perhaps from his allies in the European Union.
Well, on Monday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi opened a controversial Hindu temple dedicated to the Hindu god Ram that was built on the ruins of a razed historic mosque in the northern Indian city of Ayodhya. It's a massive political triumph for the populist leader. Here he is speaking at the inauguration.
January the 22nd, 2024 is the dawn of a new era. This is a temple of national consciousness in the form of Ram. Ram is the faith of India. Ram is the foundation of India. Ram is the idea of India. Ram is the law of India.
Ram Bharat ka vidhan hai.
Jack, this temple's on a site where Hindu mobs tore down a mosque 3 decades ago. Prime Minister Modi is in that clip saying, you know, Ram is the law of India. But why is the temple so controversial, and what did it take for this to get built?
Well, Uttar Pradesh, the state where this is being built, is almost ground zero for Modi's brand of Hindu nationalism. And this is really seen as a homecoming for devout Hindus. As we were talking about, it's a place that's believed by some Hindus to be the birthplace of the deity Rama. And just throughout the Uttar Pradesh state, I was just there a couple of months ago, you see BJP really very clearly linking themselves to Hinduism, to Hindu nationalism. They wrap themselves in the flag. If you go to the city of Varanasi, the holy city on the Ganges rivers, you see that even the crematoriums where Hindus are being cremated in hopes of salvation, the BJP flag is flying there. So Modi's face is everywhere in the country, and this is really about kind of making the country more of this majoritarian Hindu country in Modi's image.
David, what does this move say to you about how strong Modi's power is, how strong his influence is going into an election year in India?
I think it's another depressing piece of evidence that Modi is exceptionally good at playing his political game. He's playing to his Hindu base. He is willing to take remarkable risks in terms of undermining the supposedly secular multi-faith constitution of India and playing, you know, when you hear him saying that Ram is the law of India and, you know, taking, leading this ceremony, which is basically seen as the kickoff of his election campaign, this temple on top of what used to be a mosque in a site where, let's forget, 2,000 people died during those riots in 1992. This is very incendiary stuff. But the sad reality of the modern world is that countries like America, countries like my own Britain, they're giving Modi a pass because he is seen as a hedge against other more frightening powers like China. And so we are seeing him embraced as the leader of the world's largest democracy, given state visits. We have the French president on a state visit to India. There's very little appetite in the West for actually drawing attention to the really dangerous side of this Hindu nationalism in a country which, let's not forget, has 200 million Muslims in it who are feeling extremely much excluded from this democratic government of Narendra Modi.
Jack, tell us more about this pass Modi's being given, as David put it, especially when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, the relationship to India right now, and the many ways in which it's relying on India for a number of American foreign policy priorities.
Well, that's right. I mean, you see India kind of being the straw that stirs the drink in the Indo-Pacific, right? And going back all the way, almost a couple of decades, when the Japanese first really built this Indo-Pacific strategy that became the American Indo-Pacific strategy, it was all about getting India into the Western fold. And that has really kicked up a notch as India and China have been sort of fighting it out with this argy-bargy in the Himalayas. So I think you see the Indians potentially being a major swing power here. Of course, as David said, this creates a problem for the Biden administration because those human rights issues, those problems with India kind of becoming a majoritarian country, not a plural country as it historically has been, has fallen way down the list of priorities. And there's an international element to this too, right? Of course, like we've seen the Indians now targeting Sikh nationalists on Canadian soil, on American soil. So this does have global ramifications, the fact that you don't see Western officials now calling out Modi for some of these abuses.
A quick stop now in Haiti, which continues to suffer from political instability and rising gang violence. A court in Kenya has ruled that a plan to send 1,000 police officers to Haiti to lead a multinational peacekeeping force was unconstitutional. That is after the United Nations Security Council approved the creation of a Kenyan-led force in October. So, David, walk us through what was the UN's goal in creating this international force in the first place, and where does all this leave Haiti right now?
The Haitian prime minister last year basically begged the UN to send a multinational force because he said his government and his law enforcement forces had been basically overwhelmed and that gangs controlled 80% of the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince. And the UN heard that plea and basically looked around for someone who was willing to send large numbers of peacekeepers with the means to take on these criminal gangs. And we ended up with the Kenyans offering to lead the force and the Americans offering to fund much of that work. And so it was going to be potentially eventually as many as 3,000 officers, some of them from paramilitary units in the Kenyan police. What has happened is essentially a piece of Kenyan domestic politics. The opposition said that the government didn't have the legal right to send the police. You might have been able to send troops, army troops, to a peacekeeping mission, but not the police under Kenyan law, and some other objections under Kenyan law, which a court has now agreed with. But you can see the politics at work where the opposition leader who actually brought the case said that the current president of Kenya, William Ruto, was only actually offering to send the police to seek favor with Western countries like the United States. So this is yet another example of misery on one side of the world producing a very partisan political argument over in Kenya, which is all to do with whether you side with the West, with the Americans, whether you side with the global South, which is very skeptical of the West. And so you can see in so many ways this is a world on fire, as Leila said, where just so many conflicts are breaking out and becoming intensely partisan, and this sense of a division between the pro and anti-Western forces in so many countries.
Well, it's worth noting, after 40 years in the making, the world's first malaria vaccine program began this week. The first vaccine was administered in Cameroon on Monday. The country's offering the four-dose vaccine free to infants up to 6 months old. 19 other countries aim to roll out the program later this year. We have a couple of minutes before we wrap up. I'd love to hear, Leila, from you what stories you are watching for the coming week.
Well, the big one, very sadly, that's coming up, of course, is the anniversary of the devastating earthquake last year in Turkey and northwest Syria. I spent a lot of time down there last year, throughout the year, looking at the impact of these, more than 50,000 deaths, thousands of people left severely injured, homeless, and now, a year on, many of them, particularly in northwest Syria, where they have so little in the way of resources, are still suffering, still unable to rebuild their lives. And the other one we'll be keeping an eye on is the humanitarian impact of the strikes on the Houthis in Yemen, because, of course, people there already severely in need, more than 18 million people relying on humanitarian assistance, and the Houthis being redesignated as a terrorist organization and having strikes on ports and airstrips is going to really impact how people get that humanitarian assistance. NGOs are already crying out for help.
Jack, what about you?
Amna, it's the Trump factor in Europe. European officials are starting to teeth gnash about whether Trump's going to pull out of NATO, what he's going to do with Ukraine aid, a big push to get Ukraine's invite to NATO on the agenda at the Washington summit, a lot of tightening of the alliance. So, yeah, a lot of fears over in Europe about what happens next.
David, what's your top story this week?
Well, China is watching Trump, too, and hoping that that Ukraine money doesn't come, because it's going to prove China's cynical point that the West doesn't have it in it to be united, that democracies are weak and squabbling, and that tough, ruthless powers like China are going to run the world in the future.
A big thank you to our panelists this hour. David Rennie, Bureau Chief for The Economist in Beijing. From London, Leila Molana Allen, Special Correspondent at the PBS NewsHour, and Jack Detch, National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy. Thank you all for joining us. One last story before we go. It's the biggest controversy in tea since 92,000 pounds of it were dumped into the Boston Harbor in 1773. Michelle Francel, a professor of chemistry at Bryn Mawr College, says the perfect cup of tea involves lemon and salt. She says the sodium and salt counteracts the chemical process that makes tea taste bitter. Diplomats on both sides of the pond are taking all precautions to ensure that the special relationship status between the U.S. and U.K. is not affected by the storm in a teacup. Mike Kidd is our sound designer and engineer, with help from Kennedy Wright. Aileen Humphreys is the editor and producer of 1A On Demand, with help from Matthew Simonson. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. Chris Castano is our digital editor. Amanda Williams is our special projects editor. AC Valdez is our senior supervising producer. And Maya Garg is our senior managing producer. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.